and gentlemen, welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station.
Diddling.
Going to have to get my volunteers on there to change those intros from Insurgent Radio Network to White Aryan Resistance. But you know who I is. Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, here in the bunker in north central Indiana on a winter wonderland. As Hugo Winterhalter used to say. Yeah, it's a winter wonderland. Yeah, it's about 4 inches of snow so far this morning. Started out a little before about dawn, and it's piling up. But it's beautiful. It's beautiful for Gobble Gobble Day. However, I'm not eating a turkey. I'm eating a ham today. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. And then I may take in a movie. Yeah, you know me, I like movies, yeah. And whether you believe it or not, I get a lot of ideas off the movies. And also, there's a lot of philosophical things stuck away in some movies. And, you know, a lot of people don't understand it or don't realize it or don't give a damn, but I do. I get something out of a movie. Rarely is there a movie I go to see that I don't get something out of it that helps me out in my struggle. Well, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, and we're at resist.com. Yeah, it's not too long till we'll be getting our donations in for December. That's right, and we'll put them to work right away when we get them, yeah. And if you're somehow one of the very few that's gotten behind, you're going to have to be getting on the ball here. We'll be dropping you from our list of pipples, yeah. Now, I got a mystery for you, and the person who comes up with the answer, well, I can't do that because we're not a live show. But I want you to tell me whether you know the answer to it. Email, let me know. But I'm going to give you the hint right now. And at the end of the show, I'll put on the answer to the hint. Okay? Here's the question. You remember Les Paul and Mary Ford back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s? Les Paul. He's 91 or 2. He died not long ago, I believe. Still playing. He played all kinds of music. But anyhow, he was a great innovator of music, and it really helped the rock and roll industry and all kinds of music with that. He was a great guitar player, similar to Chet Atkins. But he developed electronics that really changed the music industry. And one story I heard him tell about when he was playing up in Los Angeles at one time, way back. There's a guy kept coming into the club and following him around. And he called him, I forgot now. It was a Willie or something like that, some simple name like that. Kept following him around. They did finally become friends and used to go from one music event to another. And one time they're down in L.A. and they come up to this place that there was a court recording in a studio they never heard of. So they walked in and the guy came running up. Hey, shut up. You know, we're recording here. You got to be quiet. And then he said, what's your name? He says, Les Paul. The guy said, oh, crap. And he said, come on in. And that's where they recorded the Chipmunk songs that you hear at Christmas time. Yeah. But Willie, who he never did know his last name up until that point, the guy said, "Who's your friend here?" He said, "Get ready for this. My name is Howard Hughes." And he'd been bragging to him about how he bought this small hotel up there in Hollywood, and Howard, he didn't know he had any idea who he was. And Howard wasn't too impressed because he already had amassed fortune. So anyhow, that's an interesting story. But here's the question. What was the main thing that propelled Les Paul and Mary Ford into superstardom? Otherwise, they'd have been just plain old good guitar players and singers. At the end of the show, I'll tell you. I don't think any of you will guess. Well, I think we'll cover a little more territory with David McAldam's Exiles from History here, that we've covered quite a bit of it for you in the last week or so. We're going to do a couple of more pages. And this is on sex. You know, that's pretty popular, sex. The subject of sex has been a focus for Jewish writers since biblical times. The Babylonian Talmud, which is the legal code that forms the basis of Jewish regulations, contains many references to sexual mores and commentaries. Many of these regulations are perverse. For example, Yabahamoth 55b in the Talmud permits sexual intercourse with a dead relative, whether the relative was single or married. Kethoboth 11b in the Talmud advocates sex with three-year-old girls. Sanhedrin 54b and 55a permits sodomy with three-year-old girls and boys under the age of nine. 78a of the same book allows sodomy with a dying person, but only so long as the act is committed in the presence of a rabbi. Another voyeur peeking Tom. Now, if you don't think this is true, look it up. In the Babylonian Talmud's about, I think, 20, 30 volumes. And that's what got George Lincoln Rockwell on the Jews, because like I told you before, Rockwell came out back from the Navy, and he got together with an older couple in San Diego that were supporting MacArthur for president, and he was all hot for that. But then the people said, "We're going to get a hall, we're going to do all this stuff for MacArthur." And then somebody said, "Well, I don't think that's going to work." Why? And somebody else says, "Well, the Jews, they won't let it go. They won't let us have it. They'll shut us down." And Rockwell, at that time in his life, said, "What the hell's the Jews got to do with it?" That's how far he came. Well, they said, you go down to the San Diego Library, and you get in there and start reading these books called the Talmud. So he didn't know quite what to think, so he went down to San Diego Library and got in there. They had the Talmud under lock and key. You had to get the librarian to let you in. And he spent a day or two reading this different volumes of the Talmud. And when he came out of that library, he became a Nazi. Before that, he was just like a lot of us started out, a conservative right-winger, man, till he saw the light. Lengthy debates take place within the holy books about whether or not consummation of a marriage on the Sabbath would constitute work. The lawmakers concluded that such intercourse is not work and is permissible because, quote, any act of damage does not constitute labor in regard to the Sabbath, unquote. Even the mythical Jesus is included in these bizarre sexual ramblings. Sanhedrin 105a b tells that Jesus fornicated with his jackass, unquote. Now, you can look all this stuff up if you don't believe me. And Gittin 57a in the Talmud holds that Jesus is in hell and being punished by being boiled in hot semen. Christians are boiled in shit, unquote. Well, that's because they're a competitor. They became a big competitor. And, of course, now they've pretty much been absorbed. One of the most complete accounts of Jewish sexual mores is contained in the Erotica Judaica by Alan Edwards, New York, 1967. This fascinating yet little-known book presents a sexual history of the Jews. Edwards and others have addressed the vexing issue of Jewish ritual circumcision. The French Jew Leon Poliakov, writing in The History of Anti-Semitism, suggests that the psychological trauma of circumcision contributes to the unique Jewish personality traits. Poliakov has done his homework properly, for in the United States, nearly 90% of the Gentile males are circumcised, and Americans have not yet adopted Jewish personality characteristics as a result. Another thing, too, it's a way of hiding within a non-Jewish population. If they, you know, in Germany, they used to have them drop their pants, and they'd know right away if they were a Jew. Sigmund Freud was closer to the mark when he wrote in Moses and Monotheism, quote, "Circumcision is the symbolic substitute of castration, a punishment which the primeval father dealt his sons long ago out of the fullness of his power, and whosoever accepted this symbol showed by doing so that he was ready to submit to the father's will, although it was at the cost of a painful sacrifice." However, Freud seemed to overlook the fact that the newborn infant is not in any position to have any choice in the matter of his mutilation by a mohel or by a pediatrician. Bruno Bettelheim comes much closer when he writes, quote, "Circumcision can only symbolize castration in a society where severe punishment, particularly in regard to sexual behavior, is part of the individual's frame of reference. And only where the punitive figure of an adult looms large will the child easily make the mental transition from circumcision to castration anxiety. Jewish society is one such, and so are other societies that have been influenced deeply by Judaism." Symbolic wounds, but Freud did hit the nail on the head with his remarks later in the same tome. Quote, "This feeling of guiltiness, which the prophets incessantly kept alive and which soon became the integral part of the religious system itself, it became not easy to adhere to the illusion, cherished above all else, that they were God's chosen people. The need for satisfying this feeling of guilt made them render their religious precepts ever and ever more strict, more exacting, but also more petty." Unquote. Edwards later reveals the same startling aspects of ritual circumcision, which Freud just happened to avoid mentioning. Quote, "Jews are even saddled with the sin of masturbation, owing to Gentile observance of the mohel or circumciser, routine clasping the babe's penis with thumb and forefinger and gently stimulating an erection to facilitate the delicate operation, and are heavily burdened with the terrible guilt of being phelloshimoshimax." I can't pronounce that word. "A scandal aroused by Gentile observation of the circumcisional routine of metzia, or septic suction of the wound by the circumciser's wine-daubed lips." Are you convinced now that how crazy these fucking Jews are? At least the ones who adhere to this crap. I think about half of the Jews are atheists or agnostics. Okay, a highly controversial procedure suggestive of Jewish perversion, as well as an explanatory or alleged Jewish addiction to fellation. Freud theories of sexual traumatism were thus afloat at an early age. Yeah, you find a lot of homosexuals committing homosexual acts that are Jews. That's for sure. I guess that's where they get their start. Despite much aversion to and prohibition of circumcision, early Christians were so gullible to Judaic lore that they even worshipped holy foreskins at churches throughout Europe. At least 12 examples of Jesus' foreskin were revered as holy relics at different churches. One Parisian church had the Virgin Mary's vaginal lips enshrined. All of these relics were brought back to Europe by the Crusaders. Now, I tell you, religion's wacko. Are you getting the message? Medieval times were also significant for the preponderance of Jewish converts to Christianity who were actively involved in the persecution of the Jews. In 1240, Louis IX of France set up a committee to investigate Jewish hatred of Christians. Head of committee was Nicholas Donan, a convert. In the mid-15th century in Spain, a homosexual renegade Jew, Fray Alonso de Espina, published many accusations against the Jews, his best known being Fortress of Faith Against the Jews. But Espini was by far eclipsed by his contemporary, Fray Thomas de Torquemada, the first Inquisitor General, 1483, and Papal Grand Inquisitor in 1487. As Edwards tells us, both his father and his uncle, Cardinal Juan de Torquemada, were of immediate Jewish descent. Uncle Juan became a full-fledged converso, or new Christian, rising to great eminence in the church and the state, while Thomas Sire remained a crypto-Jew, or a Marrano, literally means pig. Although he reared Thomas as a strict Christian, he had dared to have him circumcised in infancy, so that if Thomas ever wished to convert to Judaism, he was already a Jew in the flesh. Quote, this goes on to explain much of Thomas de Torquemada's excessive severity, for he was the most relentless expeller and persecutor of Jews since ancient times, a monomaniac who shedding floods of honest tears caused his victims to be burned alive. His successor, Fray Diego de Deza, was also a Christianized Jew, as was Alonso Manrique, Cardinal Archbishop of Seville and Inquisitor General from 1523 to 1538. These two may not have been circumcised, but they were anti-Judaic infatuates all the same. It's interesting how they must have got their jollies burning white non-Jews alive and torturing them. This leads us to a remarkable discovery which seems to account for much of the mad excesses of the Spanish Judaophile, phobic, 17th century Dutch theologian Philip van Limborg, on the authority of his friend and famed Amsterdam Jewish physician Isaac Arobia de Castro, wrote that the monasteries and converts of Spain and Portugal are all full of Jews, while many even of the canons, inquisitors, and bishops themselves are of Jewish descent. Even the Pope was a Jew. Anti-Pope Anacletius, 1130 to 1138, was descended from Jewish converts, a phenomenon which led St. Bernard de Clairvaux to exclaim, "A Jewish sprout has occupied the chair of Peter." Anacletius, Cardinal Pietro Pierloni, was excommunicated and therefore a papal stool was provided so that the Pope could dangle his penis through a hole to have it inspected for circumcision by a testicle toucher. I'm telling you. Pope Alexander VI was subjected to particularly rigorous examination on account of his recent name change. His prepuce was found to be intact, and he continued to reign as the Vicar of Christ. despite the fact that he continued to sire a multitude of children by a host of mistresses. And this is all built on a mythical Jesus that never existed. Oh, God. Oh, man. The more you study this stuff, the more you... It's sad, but it's funny. I mean, Jesus, how can people be so screwed up? Many Jews fled from the Spanish Inquisition and settled in North Africa, where religious tolerances prevailed. Here, many of the younger refugees became prostitutes. The men became known as the Mariconas, fags, and would often paint the word kosher over their doors to show that they only accepted kosher meat, i.e., only the circumcised. The female Jewish prostitutes became known as shika, a word passed down today as the shiksas, which charmingly now refers to any Gentile woman, especially when the Jews talk about white or Aryan women. Some writers have noted an erotic sexual undertone within modern Zionism. Leslie Hazelton's book, The Israeli Woman, first deals with the biblical Oedipal political currents. As a mystical idea, the return to Zion afforded the bond of a future, but never to be achieved in our lifetime, redemption. It was imagined, as Isaiah indicates, in terms of the return of son to mother in sexual union. She characterizes Ezekiel's prophecies as follows. The sons were to mount Zion in the role of rescuer and sexual claimant. The young groom returned to claim his bride and the son his mother. The result of the intercourse between son and mother would be the rebirth of the son himself, who would give new life to his mother by saving her from the iniquities of suffering under foreign rule and restore her innocence and light as mother and life-giver. Then she shows how modern Zionists reflect this urge. She quotes a kibbutz leader, Meir Yari, who openly referred to the sexual nature of the kibbutznik's zeal. The land they tilled, he said, was their bride, and they themselves the bridegroom who abandons himself in his bride's bosom. Thus we abandon ourselves to the motherly womb of the sanctifying earth. The modern Hebrew language, she tells us, is full of Oedipal terminology. Even archaeology is digging into the motherland, back to the womb. Gever, the Hebrew word for man, also means rooster or cock. The word for weapon is zayin, which also means penis. Thus, the phrase of Israel's armed forces can also be translated as roosters equipped with penises. Ms. Hazel, you know, I couldn't dream this stuff up, man. I tell you, this has got to be the truth. Mrs. Hazelton touches on one of the most sensitive chords in the modern Jewish theology, attitudes towards menstruation. Quote, codified in perverse detail by Joseph Caro of the Shulchan Aruch, the laws of Nida forbid sexual intercourse not only during menstruation, but for at least 7 days after to ensure that the woman is perfectly clean. Defiance of this law supposedly can lead to premature death for both partners. The detailed means of avoiding this danger make horribly fascinating reading. To touch her, a menstruating woman, in a caressing manner is punishable with lashes. He is not permitted to come into contact with her, be it even a long thing, nor should he receive aught from her. He is likewise forbidden to throw anything from his hand into her hand. The two cannot sleep together. He must not sit where she sat. But since he has to eat and drink, and his wife has to provide for the needs, he's permitted to prepare food and drink for him. She is, as long as she does not do so in his presence. She must then set the food on the table when he's out of the room. If he's in the room and sees her doing so, he cannot touch the food. Now you see where all this anti-women stuff comes from. A hell of a lot of it comes right out of Judaism. More details follow. You might want to read that hole in the sheep, hole in the sheet book about how they, during certain times when they have sex, they do it through a hole in a sheet. Sheets bed, and they make a hole in the sheet, and then they have sex through the hole to obey some of these crazy stuff. For details follow in abundance, delving into the exact color and quantity of any moisture oozing out of her body. A woman with a vaginal discharge due to a fungal infection is apparently pure, while just the suspicion that she has started menstruating, even if there is no blood, is enough to make her impure. This impurity lasts a minimum of 12 days. During the 7 days after menstruation, the woman must examine herself carefully each day. This menstrual fetishism culminates in the final proof of purity, the mikveh, a ritual bath in which the woman immerses herself at the end of the 12 days, muttering blessings the while, to emerge clean to the male touch. Oh, male, he don't want to get dirty by touching that woman, even if he hasn't taken a bath in 10 years. Quote, lest there still remain any doubt to the general uncleanliness of the female sex, it extends even to newborn children. A woman is ritually unclean for 3 weeks after a male child is born, and for double that time after the birth of a female child. Because, you know, female childs are more wicked. These insulting practices are fully supported by the Israeli government, who pass out to every bride-to-be a booklet entitled Happy Marriage, which endorses such habits by quoting experts on the dangers of bloody elements. As Hazelton points out, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, the pursuit of such habits may explain why ultra-Orthodox men are among Israeli prostitutes' most regular clientele. Other observers have noted that some Orthodox men bend the rules somewhat by covering their wife with a sheet and copulating with her through a small hole cut in the center. That's what I was talking about. Sexuality, often of a salacious nature, features throughout Holocaust literature and is often tied into the scatological descriptions. However, this whole area deserves a chapter to itself, and hence we pass over this aspect of the Jewish psychology for now. Let us draw together some of the various findings we find uncovered. We have found that the Jewish religious literature dwells on perverse sex. We discover that in the modern age, Jews are still practicing weird sex cults, such as circumcision and the rejection of a menstruating wife. We found that the rabbis will masturbate, then mutilate, and then fellatio a baby's penis. We know that the Jews often grow up in matriarchal homes, yet the adult Jew insults his wife through the rejection during menstruation and through, according to her, very few rights under civil or under religious law in the world's only Jewish theocracy, Israel. Our conclusion must be as follows. Jews suffer from an inadequacy and hatred of themselves, which is stimulated by maternal punitiveness and manifests itself in filial guilt. Fathers exercise their guilt and shame at being Jewish by performing a token castration of their male children, circumcision. But at the same time, they try to make amends to the infant by kissing his mutilated penis. Resentment against Jewish mothers is transposed into the Jewish wives by rejecting them during the most feminine period. The Jewish wives react by themselves becoming punitive against the males in the family, so the vicious cycle continues. In other chapters, we will notice the guilt phenomenon manifesting itself in other areas of Jewish life. And that's it for now. And I think you I get the message of what we're dealing with here. The Christians carry on a lot of this crap, as you heard about the about circumcised areas being kept as religious symbols and icons, and the lips from a vagina being a holy thing, you know, hanging up in the church. So there you got it, boys and girls. There's more to this. I got, well, wait a minute. There was a couple of articles here that let me see here. Article that was, I don't know what paper it was in, probably Chicago paper. A post and opinion. An article in the Jewish Post, November 26, 1976, reports a statement by Shulamit Alomi, a lady member of the Israel Parliament and a civil rights leader, in which she protects discrimination against women, particularly a passage in the Shulchan Aruch, Summary of Talmudic Laws, which equates women with dogs and pigs. I would like to point out that this crude passage, which insults women, is not something of recent origin, but expounds a doctrine that is 1900 years old. It is based on the writings of the Talmud and the rabbinical laws that are not only against women, but against all humanity. For example, Gentiles are compared to dogs. It is lawful to kill a common Jew, even on the holy Sabbath day. The statement in the Shulchan Aruch, which Mrs. Olani resents, reminds me of an adverse sign I saw back in 1939 in a park in my native Poland. It had been put up by anti-Semitic hoodlums. It said, "Entrance prohibited to Jews and dogs." If Pope John, back in 1962, could make the magnanimous move of deleting from the Catholic liturgy reference to the perfidious Jews, why can't our rabbis eliminate from the Talmud those cruel and unkind slurs against women and Gentiles and all many other ugly statements against our fellow human beings? Why don't these rabbis live by the golden rule of Hillel? Don't do to your neighbor what is hateful to you. Why should the archaic dogmas of these few fanatics besmirch the name and honor of the entire Jewish people? Following week, this same paper carried letters from rabbis who were outraged by Mrs. Schwab's sacrilegious suggestions. It is hardly surprising that Jews suffer from debilitating neurosis when they compare their loved ones to dogs and pigs. When anyone comments on this phenomenon, the Jewish defense mechanism reacts by labeling the commentator anti-Semitic, in the case of a Gentile communicator, or self-hating, in the case of a candid Jew. Far from devaluing the commentator's point, this Pavlovian reaction, in fact, underscores it. Well, let's see here. I think there was another article here. Says here, this was an article too. An ultra-Orthodox woman allowed to attend funerals, and why are women not allowed to give evidence in a Beth Din? Must be a Jewish court. It is the custom of very Orthodox circles that women do not attend funerals. One of the reasons given for this is that it's through Eve that death comes into the world. Then you wonder where all this anti-woman stuff come from. Come right out of the Jews and the Islam and all that, right down to your Christian churches. And guess how broadly the Christian nonsense has screwed people's brain up ever since this country was formed. And some of the worst nuts were the ones who escaped and came over here so that they could practice their screwed-up religion. And we call them, these were like founding fathers. On the other hand, in both the Bible and the Talmud, there are references to professional female mourners whose task it was to awaken feelings of sorrow by their wailing and weeping. On the question of women testifying in a court of law, much has been written. While it is true that the testimony of women is not accepted In civil cases, there are instances when the testimony of a woman is accepted. For instance, where a woman states that she was witness to the death of a man so that his wife is free to remarry. Women are also believed to, in all ritual matters, to declare that food is kosher, for example. It is frequently stated that the reason why the testimony of women is not accepted in civil cases is because women are unreliable. There you go, National Association for Women. Why aren't you going after the Jews? You know, in fact, most of those outfits are led by Jews. Quite apart from the fact that this is not the reason given in the Talmudic sources, if it were the reason, why is the testimony of a woman accepted in the cases we have mentioned? The late Rabbi Chavkim Hirshenson, in his book Malki Ba Kodesh, published at the time of the Balfour Declaration, when it was already foreseen that the disqualification of women would present serious problems in a Jewish state, suggests that the disqualification is on theological grounds. That is to say, it is not because women are not to be trusted to tell the truth in a court of law, but rather because the Jewish tradition did not wish cases involving financial loss to be decided by the testimony of a woman, perhaps out of feelings of delicacy, which would protect the weaker sex from becoming too much involved in cases that can be sorted. Of course, many protagonists of the women's liberation would not accept any notion of a weaker sex to be protected, and there is certainly a problem here. Jewish family life is a continual battle between matriarchy. Well, I think the Jews put a hex on me. I had to cough real bad. I had to shut off the mic. Jewish men feel dominated by their mothers and take out their anger against women on their wives. The pioneering ethnotherapist, Dr. Judith Weinstein Klein, has found that Jewish love life is aggressive, punitive, and full of rage. That comes from a Time magazine article of March 15, 1982. Jewish women are totally humiliated and negated by Jewish law, as this clipping illustrates from the Jewish Chronicle, 10 October 1980. Many of them take out their anger against society in general by becoming militant women libbers. For example, Bella Abzug, Gloria Allred, Gloria Steinem, and Betty Friedan, however vocal they may be when it comes to criticizing a woman's role in secular society, there is but a deafening silence from them when it comes to the criticizing the most male chauvinist society in the world, the Jewish society. It took a Gentile woman, Leslie Hazelton, to blow the whistle on the oppression of women in Israel, in the Israeli women. Ironically, it seems that before the imposition of Judeo-Christian values on the Middle East into Europe, Western society was extremely liberated. In Celtic Britain, women were accorded full property and marriage rights. Many Celtic women became military leaders, such as Bordecai and Cartamandaw. So there you go. That's under the pagans, women had equality in many cases. And while the Jewish women were virtual slaves. My understanding under pagan life, a lot of the shaman, the doctors of the tribe were women, working with herbs and all kinds of things to cure people's problems, which was very important to the white tribe. That's it there. Next time we're going to go into power in this Exiles from History, into the section on Jewish power, and there's a lot of good stuff in there, I'll tell you. Well, I'm going to cut it a little short today, get ready to give thanks to the white race and give thanks to my mother and father and grandfather, grandmother, and my ancestors. I really respect the Asian people, the high Asian people, which I consider the Chinese and Japanese, because I think that ancestor worship is, if you're going to worship anything, worship your ancestors. When I was last in Japan, there was little graveyards all over Tokyo, small graveyards. And they'd be on a on a weekend where people were off work, there were thousands of them. I mean, not in one spot, but over the city of Tokyo, they were at these burial plots where they bury the ashes with their flowers and so forth, and involving themselves in ancestor worship. That makes sense. Why wouldn't you worship your ancestors? However, I think in another 50 years, there's going to be white people that are going to not want to worship their ancestors very much. Maybe a few of their ancestors. Well, that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the Bunker. She-Wolf, yeah. And remember, we are white supremacists, yeah. And we're in a white racial holy war, yeah. I like that. Ben Klassen did a good job, and he's probably the best thing that came out of the right wing, because he started out like I did. He was a conservative right winger, Birch Society member. Then he became he ran for office and became a Florida legislator. But I think he saw pretty quick that that was not going to solve much. So we're going to revere any leaders, and I think Ben Klassen should be right at the top with his Nature's Eternal Religion and the White Man's Bible. Yeah. So anyhow, there you go. And shut your pie hole. And remember, you are the Aryan, the noble ones of the white race, if you're doing the right thing. And just because, don't accept anybody just because they're white. That's a very bad mistake. A lot of people in prison found that out. You can't trust anybody totally. That's just the way it is. It's a society we're living in. And specifically, if anybody tries to get you to join up with something or get with another person or two and set out to do some crazy stuff, well, that won't change anything. Think about it. Say, I don't think so. I think I'm going to stay home. I'm going to stay home listening to Tom Metzger's show.